And we are now back live running on Twitch. We're just going to stream on Twitch tonight because of some of the issues we've been having to make it easier on this. This is the first time we've had so many people on. Welcome to More Than Dice. My name is Gonzo. Yes, that is my name. That will always be my name. Below me, right below me, is my co-host tonight, is Seth Watkins. Seth, say
hey, hi. Everybody.
And we have two special guests. This is the first time we've had two guests within our podcast, which is kind of cool, if you ask me. On my left, which is actually the opposite side of the screen, is a gentleman I just kind of met recently. No, not there. Not the Mohawk. And that is Heath. Heath, say hello to everybody.
Hey guys, how's it going? I'm Heath Foley. I am one of the co-owners and lead art director for Pinnacle Games.
Okay. And on the other side with an incredibly awesome Mohawk signature is...
Hi, I'm Jonathan Phillips Bradford. I am the other co-owner of Pinnacle Games and many other things such as Eldritch Studios and Vintage Monthly.
And that's it. Seems like we actually have the best beard cast on the network right now because we all have got awesome beards. Everybody got
Stroke it.
Everything. So before we start anything, we always discuss what we're going to be drinking, what we're going to have in while we're podcasting. And Seth, what's your choice today?
Well, my choice was to go to a tasting room a couple of hours ago where I had a great variety of local brews. So tonight I will be having some delicious water out of my Batman cup.
Batman flavor.
Batman flavor? Tastes like justice. Correct.
Jonathan, are you eating or drinking anything tonight?
I'm actually drinking LaCroix. But I have fancier water than Seth.
And
but it does not come with justice.
Heath, what are you having today?
If I had my choice, I'd be drinking a Dragon's Milk Nitro Stout, but right now I've got a Arnold Palmer Arizona Iced Tea.
Well, it seems like I'm the special one tonight. I've got my bottle of Maker's Mark, as usual, and I'm going to be eating Red Hot Popcorn with this. I'm not sure how this is going to taste.
I did not prepare. I didn't bring snacks or anything.
We have a lot of fun on this. We do stupid stuff.
So if I'm lucky, I'm going to have a delivery of tacos in a little bit.
So,
man, why you got to bring up tacos?
Those tacos are awesome.
Joey.
Heath, go get us tacos.
Yeah, sure.
Heath, go ahead. We'll talk to Jonathan. If you could, like, send him, like, fax me tacos, we'll be good with that.
I just come back, and it's just like, yeah, my partner, he's terrible. I'm just like, I brought you tacos.
All right,
I really like the game, but I think we might need to reskin the art.
Reskin tacos?
Oh, Tacos the Game. Why didn't we think of that?
Tacos the Game. So let's go ahead and get started on this. And I've actually been following y'all for quite a while on your board game, because we actually have a lot of people in common on Facebook of painters and modelers and stuff like that. And I was watching it, and I actually tried to find y'all at Adepticon. I got too busy, couldn't do it, and of course I couldn't find y'all anywhere else because I'm poor and can't go to many conventions.
That's what you get for being a teacher.
Yeah. My luck for trying to mold young minds. So who would like to tell us what is Wanderer Cult of Barnacle Bay?
Alright, I can go for it. So the Wanderer universe started off a year ago, or a year and a half ago at least. Where Heath and I started a small little Kickstarter for just 5 pewter resin miniatures. Just to kind of test the waters and see what the interest was. And it did really well. We ended up getting 7 heroes made out of it. And then the first thing we kept hearing was, these guys are awesome, I love painting them, but we want a board game. And then ever since then, we started working on a board game. And now here we are today on Kickstarter with a board game. Wander the Cult of Barnacle Bay. Barnacle Bay was a peaceful fishing village until the evil cult leader Elder Bane took over the town. He's used his dark magic to corrupt the inhabitants of the city, So the once loyal bear guards are now berserking bear sharks. We got tentacle bunny zealots, fish bat casters, and crab-armed crazed otter fishermen. All the players are playing as heroes from the Wanderer's Guild, who have been sent to Barnacle Bay to save the town in this 1-5 player co-op crawl board game.
Until we said that a few times.
Yeah, I was looking for the teleprompter somewhere on the screen, just
I can keep going.
Keep going. I was going to say he's got a type 5 on this.
I was like, I can probably tell you the whole demo.
Tell me the demo. Oh, I'm used to demos. Do a ton of demos for another game, and then they got rid of us, of course. So, y'all just kicked off your Kickstarter last week, and what was it? Within 4 hours, y'all were fully funded.
Oh no, it was a little bit longer than that. It was right after 24 we were fully funded, which is still freaking awesome. I think it was right at like 26 hours, technically, that we were fully funded at $50,000.
I'm pretty sure if it funded in 4 hours, our eyes would have melted and we would have started panicking. And joy panicking. It's a thing. But we funded the first 27-ish hours or so, and honestly, we're absolutely ecstatic about that. We couldn't be happier. And as of now, as of doing this podcast, we are currently at over 100,000, which is 200% of our funding goal, which is pretty rad.
That is super awesome.
Yes, everybody celebrate. Hey, woo-hoo-hoo. So with that being said, how do you figure out what to set your funding goal at? Because, I mean, I've never kickstarted anything. I've, you know, helped fund people's Kickstarter. But how did you come up with $50,000?
Well, most of that is based off of research that we have done. So basically the whole year and a half after that Kickstarter that we did last year leading up to now, a lot of that has been spent doing game development. I mean, countless hours of game development. But the other half of that is legitimately doing research on manufacturing, shipping, pledge management, all that stuff. So the second we started making the game and really getting into it, we're like, all right, cool. Well, we know we have something on our hands here. Now, how do we actually make something that we can hold in our hands? And that's where a lot of that research came into play. And basically what we did is we started researching manufacturers over in China, because what we want from the base game is good quality at a fair price for production, so we can get something into gamers' hands that is the best thing we can possibly deliver. And honestly, we found, I think, 4 or 5 different manufacturers over there. Because we want mass production. We want all the miniatures to become pre-assembled in the game. We want the big box experience. Mm-hmm. So we started talking to manufacturers. We started sending them over really, really accurate information about what we want in the base game, what we want to be involved. And what ends up happening is they send us quotes back. We work with them a little bit, try and figure out what the best price range is, and basically compete them off of each other, because they are very, very competitive for that work. Once we found a company that... Sorry, go ahead, Jonathan.
And also, you know, before doing Panda Cult Games and Eldritch Studios, I was with Cool Money or Not for 5.5 years, so I learned a lot being there, right? I've seen a lot of the games designed, created, from beginning to end of the entire process for a very long time, and you learn a lot being there. Especially when I first started working there, there was only 10 of us at the Cool Money or Not office, and it was right at the boom of CMON, so it was a lot to learn. So we all wore a lot of hats, so everyone kind of had their fingers in a little bit of everything that was going on, and it was an amazing learning experience, to the point where luckily I have some knowledge I learned through osmosis, if you will, to work on our own company.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No problem. With being that said, and you've got your funding now, and yes, you're double your funding, and you've got tons of Kickstart, tons of extras going, of extra miniatures and stuff. What's next after this is the Kickstarter's over?
So after the Kickstarter's over, we've got a lot of things planned, but from there, we just finish up all the assets that we need, a couple more dotting our T's and crossing our I's, if you would. making sure everything's ready to go for production, finishing out all the layout of the rule book, make sure everything's edited, properly worded, make sure all our sculpts are ready to go, and then we send it all over to Longpack, and production begins. Yep. We have a goal of getting everything to everyone by September, but we wanted to just make sure to give ourselves enough time. We're pretty confident that we'll be able to deliver before then, but we didn't want to overpromise because we all know things can happen. There can be things that happen in China. There can be quality control issues. We wanted to make sure we had enough time to deliver the best product to everybody.
Yeah, literally in China, they have Chinese New Year, where basically most of the factories, most of the workers take a month off, and a lot of the workers don't come back. So, that's a production halt pretty quick there. But stuff like that has the potential to happen. So September is kind of our safe date.
So, with doing the Kickstarter, what is the biggest problem that y'all have had? What's been the thorn that's the, oh crap, this is not going to work. Oh crap, I can't do this anymore.
Well, I wouldn't say I can't do this anymore. The probably the hardest things. You never know what everybody's going to want. You think you have it laid out perfectly to deliver everybody's getting all the stuff they would want. And then the comments come pouring in, and we've very, very carefully reading every single comment that comes in. And we're like, oh, crap, people want this, not this. How can we adjust, make changes to what we've had planned without hurting ourselves financially while still appeasing everyone on the Kickstarter? Mm-hmm. That has been a very hard part. Lack of sleep is a really hard part. Because you know, we live in the U.S. Yeah, so we live in the U.S., so I normally go to bed around 2 in the morning. Around that time, people from China or Europe start making comments and talking about things, and we want to be sure to answer everybody's questions and concerns as quickly as possible. And then I can't go to sleep when I know there's a bunch of people commenting on the Kickstarter, because it's like, what if people are mad? I gotta fix this. So that would be the hardest thing. It's like a painful dream come true or an amazing filled nightmare.
Yeah. So should I have some Tim Burton music playing in the background whenever it's all over with?
Yeah. Like, yeah, all of this is just amazing. We are so grateful for all our backers, and the feedback we've been getting is just absolutely phenomenal. And the fact that we're at 100K now is just... It almost feels it's not real yet, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a little peculiar. It's going to be very real when that money gets in our bank account, and then we have to go, oh, God, we're going to have to deliver this now, which, of course, is exactly what we're
going to
do.
That's good. I honestly think like that's going to be the easier part.
We've
got all the lines and our ducks in a row for that part.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel getting it to the people is going to be the easier part because we are a three-man team, so we made sure we are not the ones handling all the shipping. We're going through a third-party shipping company to make sure it's EU-friendly and AU-friendly, getting it to all the customers in the most professional way possible instead of trying to have three people do it out of my garage.
What could go wrong with that? Come on.
Yeah.
Isn't that how Apple started?
We wanted to stick to what we're good at, right? And we're good at making this game pretty and fun and exciting and... You know, showing it off to everybody, but we're not going to be the best at managing shipping hubs and stuff like that. Like, we can talk to the shipping hubs and deal with other professionals, but we wanted to make sure that the professionals with shipping are dealing with our product.
So can I ask a question?
No.
Okay.
Podcast over. We're done. Cut in.
So long, slam dunk. Hey guys, new high score, shortest podcast.
Ever.
breaking records left and right.
So with the model production being in China, what are the models really going to be made of? Like, what kind of plastic?
Right now we're looking into PVC plastic, kind of. It's all going to become pre-assembled. Like, we've gotten some samples from our manufacturer and been taking a really close look at them because Jonathan and I are board gamers, and his wife, Elizabeth Beckley, who does Miniature Monthly with them, she knows what she's talking about quality-wise. So when they sent over a sample packet of these plastic models to us from Longpack, we really took a hard look at them. And I mean, we were like chucking them across the room and making sure that they were going to be decent quality. And we looked at it. The detail's great. It holds together really well. I mean, if there is a super thin bit and you freaking work on it, yeah, you're going to snap a piece off. But ultimately, these things are pretty resilient. We're pretty happy with them.
Yeah, we're super happy with the product samples we've gotten back. It should be up to the same detail quality as what people should expect from these big box board games.
Yeah.
Okay. Because that was the reason why we were looking at, because we deal mostly with miniature games on our podcast, and we're like, board games are now miniature games, whether you think about it or not. The day of just having a little chit for your guy is kind of out the door now. It's everybody wants full miniatures. Everybody wants something that looks good. People want something that's going to be, hey, I got this. It's good plastic. I'm going to paint it and put it on my board. So that's the reason why I'd been looking at y'all and just keeping an eye on it and everything, because I love miniature board games. That's like one of my things.
Me too.
I have a ton of board games. A big old shelf of them. But what I really like about it is the play style. Because there's one aspect I like about your game more than anything else, and it's they can be played by one person.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm actually really curious about
that.
From
one to five players.
So how does one player work? Because I've heard of this concept, I've never seen it in practice.
Okay, so when you're playing one player, you will need to play at least two heroes for some scenarios. Well, the game does scale up and down for the amount of heroes being played. In many ways, one of the main ways is the amount of enemies that are spawned onto the board are scaled by the amount of heroes in the party. So, amount of enemies on the board. So, when you spawn an encounter, you spawn one spawn card per hero on the board, plus one spawn card for every large size tile on the encounter. So the amount of enemies is dictated by how many players are being played, and then how large the encounter of the area is. Mm-hmm. So only two heroes is going to be less monsters than three heroes, four heroes, five heroes. You will need to play a minimum of two heroes for a lot of scenarios, some of the scenarios, because there's scenarios where the parties have to split to win the objectives. There's two different objective points in different parts of the map that you have to split up and get to at the same time. So you would have to play at least a minimum two heroes. All the enemies and the bad guys are completely automated. This is a co-op game, and a pet peeve of mine in other co-op games has been when you have to roll dice against your friends. One thing I wanted to be sure of when designing this is you are only rolling your own dice. All the enemies do automatic damage towards you when they attack. You just have to roll your defense. When you attack, enemies have a static defense that you have to break through. And it keeps the game fast-paced, so you're not only have to, I attacked, now he defended, now he's attacking me, let me roll for that, okay, now I defend, and I roll. It broke the immersion of, I am this guy, and we are on this adventure, and me and my friends are working together, instead of me and my friends working together, now I have to roll for the bad guy, and I'm like, oh, sorry, I kind of killed you, I didn't mean to. That's not the environment we wanted to create, and so the game is very fast-paced and automated to the point that you can literally play with as many heroes as you want, as one person, well, not as you want, up to five. You can play two to five heroes and go against the bad guy, and the board can kick your butt very quickly.
I'll put it this way. I'm the kind of guy that loves a Denny's menu because I can just point at a thing and grunt in order. So when it came to actually helping Jonathan, so Jonathan is the main guy behind the rules for this game. I've just kind of been a good counterbalance to him for like, no, that's way too vicious, or hey, this makes me feel good, we should keep this kind of stuff in. But ultimately, I'm kind of dumb when it comes to board games, but I've been getting better through the process of working on it. So when we have been developing this thing, I wanted to be very clear ahead of time, like, oh, I can operate this one hero and I have no issues. Or I can operate two of these heroes and have no issues. So keeping track of two heroes, we make it very simple. It's just, it's small numbers. It's not a bunch of giant math. You're not chucking 18 D6s and then waiting 30 minutes for your friend to figure out how much damage they did. It's literally smaller numbers, quick, fast-paced gameplay. So someone even like me can get in there, play one or two heroes, and we'll be like, you know what? I'm 100% on board. I know what I'm doing. It's easy to pick up. I mean, we've had people play the demo of the game, and they play like Adepticon, perfect example, which was a glorious show for us. We showed off the game to this one guy, and he left. He came back all excited, and then he brought three of his friends. and then they left. It came back. Brought more people to play the game. And then once the hall closed, he came back by and he was like, hey, can we play the game again? We're like, yeah, we're all bored. That's awesome. So there was like 5 or 7 people sitting around playing our board game one night. And Jonathan and I are just sitting in chairs, sitting back, because they learned the rules and they figured out the system so quickly that they were just playing it on their own. We were just there for overly complex answers. And it was a beautiful thing to see. So we've worked really hard at making it a relatively simple system that's got a deep level of strategy to it.
Yeah, we really wanted to make sure the game was simple to play, but challenging to win. It's easy to play the game. You know how to move your characters. You know what you're capable of doing. It's not a lot of complexity of how to play it, but you have to work together or you will lose. You have to make the right decisions and work together in the right way, or the board game's going to beat you up. Because I feel like if a game is co-op, it has to be challenging, or what's the point? You have to have something going against you.
Mm-hmm. So, I'm guessing, Jonathan, you're the one that worked on all the rules? And just...
Yes.
Did you designed the rules and then ran it by them. How many iterations did you go through on the rules?
Heath and I have been working on the rules for a long time.
I mean, it's almost a fluid
but
process.
My general idea of what I wanted from the beginning has come true in the end. What I pictured the game, what we wanted the game to be, has come true. It just took a long process to make it all work seamlessly. And coming up with new unique ideas along the way. Working at CMON, there's a couple of mantras I've learned when it comes to game design. Never make a rule for a rule, because then it's not a good rule. If you have to make up rules to fix other rules, then you shouldn't have it. Mm-hmm. And also, try to avoid if and then rules. Meaning, you do this, like, when you're, like, you roll to attack, unless this is happening, then you do this. But if this is happening, then you do that. That keeps the game more streamlined and more dynamic. So avoid if and then rules. Don't make rules to fix rules, and keep it simple. A game doesn't have to be overly complex to be fun. You want people to open a box, especially with a board game. You want people to open a box, go over the rules, and just start at it. It's always a little of a downer when you get a new game, and you and your friends just want to open it up and play it, but then you realize you're probably going to have to spend the next several hours sitting and reading and kind of learning it and figuring it out. We want people to just be able to jump right in. And then, almost like a video game, like old-school video games. Anyone can pick up Mario and play Mario. They know how to run, they know how to jump. But you have to learn how to do it properly to win. And that's kind of how we went with our board game.
Yeah. So my wife has a really simple rule. She's not willing to play games with me if she can't learn the rules in less than 5 minutes. More than that, she usually has like a 3-rule max, but we can stretch it sometimes. Is this a game that might be good for her? Or is it a little too complicated?
We have our demo to be able to show you almost all the base mechanics of the game. We can get you through in 15. To be able to know how to activate your character literally takes you 1 or 2 turns.
Yeah.
Nice. Really, you move, you attack, you decide which way you want to go, you decide which abilities you're going to take.
And so,
now, how to use those properly takes a little bit more time.
Gotcha.
Like, especially since it's co-op, right? If you know the rule, if you understand the game, she can be playing with you in no time flat.
And speaking of such...
tacos!
Taco time, everybody!
Aww.
That's so not fair. Not fair.
So, with you.
Going back and talking about part of the production and stuff and the miniatures that you have, y'all got some really interesting sculpts. This isn't just your, here's your ogre, here's your orc, here's your, you know, whatever. Who did your sculpting, and did you do it digital or conventional?
Oh, I got
that
this.
Is
also,
you got it. Go.
I got it. I got to give this man all the kudos in the world. So all of our sculpts for the game thus far have been done by Patrick Keith. You may know Patrick Keith. Yeah, the amazing, the illustrious, the incredible Patrick Keith. He is an amazing sculptor, and he's an amazing human being. He's literally, I like to think of him as like my industry uncle, like this awesome dude who I see at all the shows, and we love hanging out with him and grabbing a margarita. Patrick has been sculpting for, I think, 15 plus years at this point. He has sculpted for Privateer, Dark Sword. He's got his own Reaper. Line of models. Reaper, yeah. He's got his own line of stuff with Bombshell Babes and Bombshell Miniatures. He's got his own game called Counterblast, which is really fun. Patrick has been sculpting for a really long time. So when it came down to... So when we did the Kickstarter last year, as an example, I thought... instantaneously, I was doing a lot of chibi art at the time for Ninja Division. So when we were working on the miniature line, I was like, I like chibis, but, you know, I'm not 100% on board with making that kind of visual style for the game. So we went for more of a cartoony edge to it. So my first thought was, you know, well, maybe we need to find a sculptor who specializes in cartoony stuff. So I hunted a guy down, and the initial sculpts we got were great. But after I showed him to Patrick and kind of talked to him about it, he was like, Heath, why didn't you come to me with this? And I was like, oh, I didn't know this was in your wheelhouse. And he was like, dude, I've been sculpting forever. Everything's in my wheelhouse. And I was like, oh, okay, Patrick, that's fine. So
yes, please.
Yes, please, and thanks. Like, Patrick is, he should be a legend. I honestly think he is. He just hasn't gotten enough credit for it. So when it came to working on the board game, the first instantaneous thought we had is who are we going to get to sculpt these insane designs I'm coming up with was Patrick Heath. He is the go-to guy. So Patrick Heath
been,
is he, a
Elizabeth's been painting for him for years. She's always been a huge fan. Yeah. We've all been fans of his work. So once we realized Patrick Heath was going to be our sculptor, we all kind of like had a little bit of a fanboy moment. Like, oh my God!
Yeah, watching his sculpt work in progress pics come in were glorious. And you asked if he's digital or traditional. He's traditional. He's old school.
He is.
So he's doing that stuff by hand. There's a couple of things that he can do in 3D sculpting. Like he's helped us tweak some designs in the past for some things that we had done in 3D that he's assisted us with before. Last Kickstarter, this one, 100% Patrick so far. He's done all the sculpting. It's all been done traditionally, and it is beautiful. I am so happy with it. I mean, just every time I see the otter crab and put one on the table, it makes me giggle because it's so freaking adorable and fantastic.
Yeah, I had actually met Patrick Keith because I didn't know who was doing it because I was curious because mm-hmm. I'm actually going to be having Patrick Keith and Doug Hamilton.
Oh, awesome.
On my show, and we're going to be discussing the differences and discussing different, because Doug's strictly 3D, and Patrick mm-hmm. is traditional, and so we're going to have them on our show talking about that, because people have been wondering. So I'm actually excited that Patrick Keith did it, because I think he's amazing also.
Yeah.
He is. Incredible.
We can't sing his praises, like, the most. He's just he's the best guy to work with. Like, even besides his amazing talent, like, just working with him is phenomenal. He's always, yeah. It's just everything. I have no negative things to say about Patrick. He's all the best.
I think it's funny
that... Does he have a good
beard? Patrick doesn't have a beard.
He has a goatee, if I remember right.
Yeah, he has some facial hair.
He's back in.
I bet you if Patrick's kind of like Chuck Norris. If he wants a beard, he'll grow a beard.
Beards want Patrick.
Yeah. Patrick.
Well, that's bad.
Well, maybe beards do want Patrick. We don't know.
That's true.
He'll sculpt his own. Oh,
his wife is going to beat me up.
He's going to sculpt his own beard.
He could. I know exactly how it would look, too. It'd be fantastic.
He's just going to have this big beard made out of putty.
We'll see about the next one. He'll be like, hey, guys, how's it going? We're going to be like, Patrick, why is your beard pink?
I'm in the processing stage. It hasn't dried yet and painted, so just give it a minute.
Elizabeth's going to start painting his beard.
He's just got a hair dryer, and he's like, guys, it's hard. Just give it a few minutes. man.
Going back on the models, these are all unpainted models, and they can take primer and paint really well?
Yes. We actually have... painted versions of one of our updates. We're going to add them to the page. We just haven't yet. We do have paint also on our BGG page. We have painted versions of all the enemies that are painted so far. We've also posted work in progress. Elizabeth is currently working on Roland and Elder Bane. They do paint up beautifully. I could probably pull up one and do a screen share.
Well, to be fair as well, Elizabeth is a professional-grade studio miniature painter, so I'm pretty sure she can get her hands on anything painted up beautifully. But normally, like, if she had any complaints...
That's great.
Yeah, absolutely. But no, normally, if she would have any complaints about model quality or anything like that, she'd tell us straight up, and we haven't heard a peep. She's just been like, I love painting the otter crab, and it's like, ah, okay.
See, I picture y'all going through production, and she's looking at the miniature, she just chunks it at Jonathan and go, get better with it, and then just goes back to work on something
that's
else.
That's not too far.
Oh, no.
That's not very far from the truth at all.
No, not at all. She saw it, she'd just be like, this mold line's terrible. Fix it. It's like, okay.
If I do screen share, is it going to work on here, since it's going through XSplit or no?
It might. I haven't done
I'll try it.
Let's see, because if it would, it would show up on your,
bam! Screen.
Negative.
Nope!
Wait. Oh, you got rid of everybody. Everybody's disappeared. Oh, there is one.
It's Bear Shark.
Yeah.
It's Bear Shark.
Yep.
All right.
It's kind of cut off a bit. There you go.
Da-da-da-da.
I'm going to open
full size.
We're super professional.
There's the crab otter fisherman from Lazy Beef. I don't know if you guys can see that.
Hold on. I'm putting stuff in the background. There you go.
So you guys can see that one?
There we go. Now they can see it. We had a little bit of lag delay whenever I tried to fix stuff, but...
That's fair. I'm sorry. Am I breaking the show?
No. I just got to reposition stuff all the time. How big are these? What size millimeter are these?
So they're all 32 millimeter, except for the Bear Shark. He is 42 millimeter, which is pretty massive. If you stepped on a Bear Shark, it caused some real pain. But yeah, they're all 32 to 34 millimeter. We know a lot of the other kind of cartoony/chibi-style games out there have models around the similar size, and we wanted to have something a little bit bigger on the table, something a little bit more fun to kind of dig into those details and paint up. I mean, we've had so many hobbyists knocking at our door asking us, you know, hey, can we get the Bear Shark, or can we get the otter crab? I really want to paint them. We're like, we can't do that. We can't do it yet. Just back the Kickstarter. It'll be great.
Well, didn't y'all do a contest for painted up model?
We did. We did indeed, which was won by Andrew Mayer. Yeah, it was just a contest. Yeah, it's just unpainted Bear Shark, which we basically got a bunch of hobbyists out there, and we said, hey, you know, if you guys... paint up any of your pre-existing water models you picked up and send us some photos, even work in progress, doesn't have to be a finished model. By the end of the week, we'll announce a winner. We'll pick one of you guys randomly and we'll send out a Bear Shark. And we got so many people started sending in models and pics. It was great. It's wonderful to see people actually paint these things up. Like, I can't wait until we get the board game and all these additional heroes out there into the world and see what people do with them. It's one of the most rewarding aspects of this whole thing, is seeing other people's creativity on this kind of blank canvas that we've given them. I mean, it's a lion and plate mail.
It's very surreal to see people I don't personally know talking about Wander and posting painted miniatures about it.
Yeah.
That is so strange to me. Like, how do these people know about this? This is really weird.
Like, it's bizarre. The magic of the internet is wild for us.
We were featured on Beast of War recently. They were talking about top podcasts of the week, and they were talking about our show, and that was just the strangest thing to me. Like, these people that I've never met before are in England right now talking about my game, and that is amazing.
Get you all giggly, get all fangirl, and just...
Yeah, just, kind of, yay!
Just a little.
Just a little.
Slight freak out.
I can see that.
Slight fangirl freak out. Well, honestly, because of how exhausting a three-person team running a big Kickstarter is, it's kind of like, yay. Because if we have a moment to sleep, we take it. Naps are keeping us alive.
Oh, I'm sure. We did have some questions from some of the viewers and a couple people that were on our Facebook page. Awesome. One of the ones that came on the buy-in later after the Kickstarter's ended. Because
we are not sure about that one. We may be able to open late pledges, but right now we just don't have the answer for that, so we can't promise that yet. First, we have to make sure putting all of our time and energy into making sure everything on this Kickstarter page is going properly right in the moment. And then we will work on our pledge manager, and once the pledge manager is up and open, we will see what our capabilities are of doing late pledges.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I know some that's been kind of a thing that's going on lately with Kickstarters is I didn't get to do it because A, I'm too poor, or you know, something came up, I didn't get in on it, and they're like, well, we're going to open it up again, and you get to have it, just go to our website, and you can do it there also. So some people are asking.
Yeah, we're not saying no, but it's something we would like to do, is what I was saying. We would like to do that, we just have to see what we're capable of doing first.
Yeah, again, we are, and we've had to reiterate this on Kickstarter a couple times, and I understand why. We have a very professional-looking product, and a lot of people said, you know, if this is on CBON shelves or Fantasy Fights shelves, like it would blend in naturally. Like it looks really good. So I think a lot of people don't seem to understand that we are three people behind this. Me doing art, Jonathan doing rules, Elizabeth painting models, and making sure we don't die. she is team mom, and we love her to death for it. Love you, Liz. Yeah, like we're a small team, so we're trying to figure out as much stuff as we can and get as much info out there as we can. So right now, like Jonathan was saying, 99% of our energy is dedicated to making sure the Kickstarter runs smoothly, that we see all the comments and questions, that we can adjust where we need to. We will figure out late pledges. If we decide to do so, we'll make a big announcement, either update on the Kickstarter, update on our Facebook. We've got social media outlets galore, and we will inform everyone of the decision we make.
Another one I've had on here is, will we get to see colored versions of the black and white sketches for the villains?
Yes.
On the Kickstarter, you'll have just sketches on there that I saw last time, and I guess they're wanting to know if you'll have it.
Yes, those will be done. Guarantee it's just not right at the moment because we are creating some of these ideas was not our original plans on the Kickstarter page. Listened to our backers, a lot of people had a lot of requests for things, and we decided to make it happen. So we originally did not have a alternate version of John the Bard or Reign of the Dragoon, and Heath decided to draw it right then and there and made it happen. We are doing our best to make sure everybody in the Kickstarter is super happy. And we were delivering everything with that in our means possible, what everyone could hope for.
Yeah, I'm planning on tackling it as soon as I can. Trust me when I say that. It's just really listening to the fans and trying to kind of adjust on the fly. It takes some energy, not to mention all the graphics needing to be updated and changed because we keep breaking through stretch goals pretty fast, which has been fantastic. Every time that happens, we have to adjust graphics and fix things and possibly draw new stuff if we shift some things around. So it's in the plan. Definitely colored stuff is coming. That's one of my primary concerns in this next week, is starting to tackle those.
Nothing is staying black and white, period.
No.
Nothing is going to stay black and white.
That is, I'm drawing everything, so that is unacceptable to me, is to leave them in black and white. That won't be happening. There's definitely going to be glorious color up to the notch of all the other designs, or better.
And luckily, people have gotten to see what everything looks, what other things have looked like colored, so they know it's going to be to the standard of everything else in the game. They know how nice Heath's artwork is when it's completely finished. The sketches help give them an idea of what it's going to be, and they can, and then they'll see as it progresses over time.
Okay. Seth, you had some questions from one of our Facebook viewers on the stuff. What did he have to say?
Sure. These questions are about after the Kickstarter is over. So, first up, are there other heroes planned for after the Kickstarter ends? Is this going to be an ongoing game, or is this a one-time deal?
We have literally endless, like, exciting heroes that we want to make for this game. We'll do everything we can to put as much into the Kickstarter, and then after the Kickstarter, the game's released, and if the game's doing well, that means we'll have enough funds to continue to make other heroes, and possibly more expansions that we've talked about on other shows, and we plan on Wander becoming an ever-growing world, right? Barnacle Bay is just the first story. We want it to keep growing and growing and growing, and with that, we'll become new heroes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. We're not short on hero ideas, to put it that way. I think we have a Excel file of something like 30-plus hero combinations, like animal and kind of traditional D&D class or some kind of other weird fantasy build we did, like a Golemancer or a Runecaster or a Toxophile or a Plague Knight or, it's endless. So really, we're not short on ideas, we're just short on funding. So we are planning on supporting the game, putting out more heroes, trying to do some more kind of store support stuff. So it depends on where things go. Hopefully, if we can get some good game sales after the game comes out, which we're hopeful for, we think we've made something pretty good, so we're hoping other people agree and start picking it up. We can really start pouring that money into some more development of some fun stuff.
So, thinking of the future, are you thinking about selling these heroes as singles, or that's going to be boxed in groups similar like Zombicide?
We plan on for them to be single little hero expansions that you can buy. Think kind of similar to what you would see with Super Dungeon Explorer. You would see the big game box, and then all these different little heroes you can add on whenever you like.
Mm-hmm.
That would not, besides the fact of like the High Tide expansion, that will be one box with all the stuff including that one box. But as for individual heroes, for now, we plan them for to be individually packaged.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you said you've got a list of all these different ideas, you've got combinations. What would Gonzo become in this game?
The greatest weirdo ever. I mean, come on. Give it the program.
He'd be a duck.
Let's see.
A what?
I was thinking a duck or I was thinking more of an aardvark.
Aardvark? I could see aardvark. Duck
how about,
or aardvark?
How about a duck bark?
A duck fart?
An aardvark?
A duck fart?
I keep mixing the two together, and I'm like, I'm dangerously close to saying something bad here. no, I could see, I don't know why, that's the first thing that came up in my head is some kind of duck character. Normally that first gut reaction is right, so.
We did have ideas for a duck dervish to be kind of Darkwing Duck-esque.
Yeah, we did have a kind of Darkwing Duck-ish idea.
That will have to wait till the future, though.
Max Payne had suggested a platypus. I kind of like that as a compromise.
We have a platypus plan for sure.
We have a platypus plan.
We can't reveal that yet, though. We can't reveal that yet. We definitely have some very cool idea for a platypus.
Mm-hmm. I'll put it this way. We'll have to see where the Kickstarter is going for the platypus.
I really hope we get that far. It may not happen yet.
Yeah, oh, so yeah. Where you're telling us as a secret, don't tell anybody else, this is not going to go out and tell anybody, that the platypus may be somewhere on that that tree of goals?
Yes. Because we had a lot of people saying we need to be prepared for this Kickstarter to go blow up, like the possibilities of a Seamon Kickstarter, which we did not think that was going to happen, but everyone said we need to be prepared just in case it does. So we have an endless list of things, and there's a platypus in there that I'd be super excited if we got to. we may even move some things around just so I can appease myself and make sure that happens.
But I mean,
okay,
that
I won't tell anybody. So we won't. If you tell me where it is, I will not tell a soul. I'll just go ahead and mute everything, and you just say it out loud.
See, what would be the fun of that for us? We want you to be surprised too.
All I'm thinking is, Gonzo, if you mute this, we may never get it back.
That is true. That is true. Mm. Going with the game, if you were going to compare games, because everybody does this, it's like, what is your game like? What is your game, if I'm going to pick it up, what, and not compare it as in, better or worse, but what would you compare it to that would be, it reminds me, but is different, but is this fun type of mentality of it?
Let's see. A lot of people have compared it to a mixture of Mice and Mystics meets Zombicide meets Betrayal and House on Haunted Hill meets Arcadia Quest meets something else. So there's a lot of comparison. There's a, there's a lot of similarities between our game and other different games in different aspects. But it was the fact of borrowing, because no game out there is completely unique. Every mechanic is inspired from a previous mechanic of something like and developed into its own thing. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite things someone said, it's like you took Dark Souls, or no, took Disney's Zootopia mixed with Dungeons & Dragons thrown into the universe of Souls. I think that was my favorite that someone told me.
yeah, that was fun.
But yeah, it's a co-op dungeon crawler, so that is a familiar aspect to it. The only real similarity between Zombicide is the fact that there's the XP tracker. So when you kill enemies, you click up an XP that can get you new abilities and so forth. But that's not really new to Zombicide. They didn't really invent experience and, you know, gaining abilities. But if I had to compare it to something, it's in that same genre. Genre of co-op, miniature board game, working together, chucking dice, making hard decisions, dying a lot.
So you were talking about the XP, and this has got me interested because I've played other board games that are similar that you're talking about. Like, I have Mice and Mystics, which I really liked because it was the co-op and everything, and they had experience, and then they got expansions that come out. If you're playing those characters and they get XP, does that XP carry over to expansions, or do they start over?
So, the campaign of Barnacle Bay is quite different than other games. That is something I'm super proud of. So after you defeat the first intro mission, which is the little intro scenario we play in the gameplay video, you then open up a choose-your-own-adventure campaign system. You get to keep all the new loot you've gained and choose 1 to 3 different level 1 missions. After you do that, you choose another... So there's another 3 options of choosing what's path to take in Barnacle Bay, and so on and so on. And then you get to further depths of Barnacle Bay, which does harder scenarios. The monsters have more stats, new unique abilities. For example, archers at level 1 only do a base of 1 damage, but archers at level 2 do 2 damage plus poison. Different enemies start becoming more dynamic and more unique as you get further into the game, which is intentional to allow you for the game to start off, allow you to learn how all the enemies work at their base core level, and as you get further, they become more and more diverse and dynamic instead of throwing it all at you at once. After you defeat a scenario, your experience actually resets, and then you keep all your new loot. That allows a couple of different things for a campaign system that most other games don't do. Each character has a essentially an experience tree, like kind of like an MMO or a lot of video games, allowing you to specialize your character, going offensive, going defensive, unlocking new abilities. Since your experience resets every scenario, you're allowed to try different builds every single mission. Because there's some scenarios you're going to want to go way more offensive, some characters want to go more mobile or more defensive, and the scenarios are going to require the party to probably spec the best way possible to work together. Another fantastic thing about this is we've all played a campaign of some sort, and then a friend comes over and he wants to jump in and play, and there's no real way to add him in. With Barnacle Bay, that's not an issue. You can just give him a character, chalk him a couple of new item cards for the level you're at, and you are good to go. And then you can start working on a new mission. Think of it almost like more like adrenaline, and then your gear is your long-term progression. Experience is more your short-term progression for each scenario to keep that ramp-up feeling of dynamic fighting and gaining new abilities happening constantly, while the long-term progression is gaining new loot, which also grants you new bonuses and special effects.
I like that.
Sorry.
No, it's fine. When you're passionate about something, you talk about it, and you're proud of it, so I totally get that.
If you let us ramble, we'll go on for about 6 hours.
I can go on forever.
Oh, yeah. I'm also the timekeeper, so I have to make sure. Now,
with that in mind, I say keep going. This is amazing.
Yeah. When I messaged you, because we did a podcast on things we were looking forward to, games coming out, and I said that I was really looking forward to your game because I've been following it and everything, you were actually at Gen Con.
Yes.
When I messaged you. How was Gen Con? Is this your first time doing it behind the scenes?
No, well, like I said, I've never been not behind the scenes in our industry. I've never not been working at a convention. So that's not new to me.
It was the first Gen Con as us, as Pandacold.
It was the first Gen Con as my own game company.
That's what I'm saying. This was your first game company. Yeah. Last year you weren't doing it as Panda. You were doing it working or whatever.
Yeah, I was doing video production for a couple different game companies last year and the year before that. And the years before that, I was doing it with Cool Winnie or Not. But this is the first year with my own booth showing off my own product. You know, instead of selling everyone else's stuff, I got to sell my own stuff. And it was bonkers.
Yeah.
It was absolutely amazing. We completely underestimated the hype that we were going to have. Just like Adepticon, we had a 10 by 10 booth, two demos running, and the booth was absolutely packed, open to close, every single day.
10 to 15 people inside of the booth nonstop.
There was points I couldn't even fit into our booth.
Yeah, it was a bit claustrophobic. Let me put it this way. I think we calculated out that we demoed to at least 2,000 people. And that doesn't even count the people they told, the people they showed it off to, the people that were walking by while we were demoing. Gen Con was nuts. And we had those models from the Kickstarter we did last year for sale there. And we actually sold enough of those models to be able to pay for the booth the next year as well. So we're definitely going
to
be at Gen Con
2018. We're essentially selling out of models to a game that doesn't exist yet.
That's pretty damn good.
That felt good. I mean, we were confident the game was going to get made no matter what we were doing. So it's not just like, here, have this thing for something that isn't real. But we were really proud, really, really, really happy. And I mean, the response we were getting at Gen Con, like Adepticon, blew our minds. People who demo the game love the game. We've had only a few people ever walk away from it in the thousands of people who have tried it, and mainly because they say, oh, well, I'm not, you know, the art style isn't my thing, or I'm a Eurostyle gamer, not a, you know, Ameritrash gamer. We're like, okay, that's fair. We can't fault you for that whatsoever. Hmm. But 99% of people are like, this game is fun. I want to play this more, which is exactly what we want.
One of my favorite moments was probably Origins. Jonathan Ying, who's the game designer for Imperial Assault, came and played the game. Mm-hmm. And he was telling me about what he did. And I was like, oh, man, you did Imperial Assault. I love that game. And he demoed. And he looked at me and goes, I think you just made one of my favorite dungeon crawlers. And I almost just, like, fell over. Just like, it was amazing. He was like, I'm really impressed. You know, how's this your first game? The roles are so tight and fluid. And coming from a big name game designer for such a hugely successful game, telling me that was just amazing. Like, I can't put words to it.
That's awesome. Seth, I know that you probably have a lot of questions about the hobby part of it.
I mean, so some of the stuff that I immediately thought of first is, so if we want to get the models from the previous Kickstarter, is there a way to get those right now?
Yes.
So, as in on the Kickstarter or just as individuals?
Just as the individuals, because I know you've been selling those at cons.
Yes. Those are for sale. Go ahead, Heath.
So, those are on sale at the redpandaminiatures.com. There is a store tab. You click on that. You'll see all the models. Most of the models are $12 a piece. Tank is $15 just because he's a giant chunk. They're all unassembled. And they're all made out of pewter, just so you guys know. But we've gotten a lot of really good responses. Like, people on the Kickstarter were asking a lot of questions about quality, and most of the responses were from people who picked them up before, saying they're really good, really tight, nice quality, fun to paint, easy to put together, mold lines are really minimal cleanup, and I was very happy to see all of that. Because that was my first time making a line of models. I knew the right people to work with, but you can only hope so well by the end product. It's going to come out exactly like you intended it to.
So for the game pieces, since they are pre-assembled, as a hobbyist, one of the things I want to be able to do is make bases that will fit with the tiles, that'll fit in a little bit better, make it a little bit more thematic. Is that still possible, or is it going to be a little bit more challenging since they are a single piece?
I think that's a hard question, because you could easily snip them off the bases that they come with, right? Mm. And you can make your own bases however you want. So it wouldn't be much different than getting, let's say, the Super Dungeon Explorer model and then doing your own designs with it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, what we've been...
Sorry, go ahead.
What we've been doing with all of our beta testing is we've been using models and putting them on 1-inch bases, just little, you know, 25 millimeter bases. And four of those fit into one square just fine. So we made sure, like, there was a lot of very carefully calculated moves to make sure that these are 32mm models. They can fit on a 1-inch base, except for the Bear Shark, because he doesn't need a base, because he's a brick, and we love him to death for it. Yeah, you don't need a base for the Bear Shark. He is just going to show up and start bashing things. But all the heroes fit on 1-inch bases. So I knew there was a lot of standard 1-inch bases out there that, you know, different hobbyists would want to try and take care of, because that's where a lot of our beginnings were, was with hobbyists. So we want to make sure we're trying to do right by them.
Yeah, we want to make sure the game still paints up well. We want to make sure people can take these board game pieces and use them as art as well.
Mm-hmm. With that in mind, after the Kickstarter, is there any thought of selling the core models in pewter or in resin, anything like that?
Like, you're saying like selling like a Bear Shark individually or something like that?
Either selling a Bear Shark individually or, I'm blanking on the name, but the Red Panda
Roland
building. Roland.
Roland. Yeah.
Selling like a resin version of Roland with the intention of it being more of an art piece.
That is something we thought about, but we really can't. It's a lot of wait and see, right? We have to see what we can afford to do. We do have exciting ideas for possibilities of some new hobby stuff coming out by Gen Con next year. I don't know if Heath, if you want to say that yet or not.
I kind of told people about it. Yeah. Okay. So we'll share it on here. We have some intentions. Because we started with hobbyists. Jonathan's wife is pro-grade hobbyist. And so a lot of discussions have been happening around the idea of busts, of possibly doing a little art series of wonder busts at some point or another. I don't know how many we would do. We definitely have one core idea really solidly set up, which is I think the first one we want to do, is it Mary Fix-It?
Yeah.
Is that the one?
So the character Mary Fix-It, who we locked on the Kickstarter, we're thinking about doing a bust version of her for Adepticon next year. No promises, but something we'd like to do. Mary Fix-It, of her giant golem and a little Mary Fix-It riding on the shoulders of the golem.
So if you guys go to the Kickstarter, which you can look up Wander on Kickstarter and find us pretty quickly, you'll see that we've unlocked a hero called Mary Fix-It. Mary Fix-It is Golemancer, so it's literally a Finnick Fox, a little female character, riding on the shoulder of this big sandstone golem. And for a bust, what we want to do is try and make the sandstone golem a little bit bigger, add a little bit more material to him, put her in a fun pose, just because I think that'd be awesome. But these things do cost money. We got to make sure that after the Kickstarter is good and set up and good to go, that we're in a place where that is financially responsible for us to do. Because there is a lot involved in the Kickstarter. There's shipping and production, and things can go wrong. And, you know, if we have any excess funds, we're not going to touch them until we know everything is okay. Everything
we don't want to count our chickens before they hatch, essentially.
Yeah, 100%. So busts are definitely, from the hobby side of things, that is definitely the next project we have in mind.
There's endless stuff that we want to do. Like, yeah, we are so excited about this line. We can literally go on and on about all the things we really want to do. And doing busts, a line of busts for the painters, is definitely one of them. We just really we're trying to make sure we're putting all of our focus into making sure this Kickstarter goes well. And then after that, we can assess and then figure out what our next dreams and aspirations are.
Yeah, nice. Having some kind of way to generate finances will be a great way to say, yeah, we could do busts. We just got to sell X amount of games.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So we got a couple questions from the chat. Are there ever going to be plastic sculpts of the younger versions of the characters?
As of right now, that is not one of our plans. No. The younger version of the characters are... We put them on this Kickstarter so people were able to get in on the deal that they missed out on last year. We now have alternate versions of more updated to the core game and pre-assembled plastics. As of right now, we're probably going to leave those, but who knows? That's not in the immediate future.
Yeah.
Someone else would like to know. Vicky would like to know. With the dice in the core box, do you get 6 dice in the core box or 12? She's trying to decide 12. If she should grab the extra. Cool.
You get 12 dice in the core box. The campaign, the Wanderer's dice, the add-on, is for people who like to have extra dice, don't like to share dice across the table, and people just like to collect different dice because we've had a lot of people asking for a unique, like, Kickstarter brand of dice. So we did the Wanderer's Guild, which is the same odds, but it has the Wanderer's Guild symbol instead of the crit symbol.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, this one is from Game Ginny, and I am going to make this work. What is a megalopotamus?
Megalopotamus.
It is just megalopotamus.
Megalopotamus.
What is a megalopotamus?
All right, it is so... half hippopotamus, half megalodon shark, and mutated craziness.
Yeah. So when we were originally working on it, we had the idea of having this giant monstrosity in the game, something that they summon from the deep sea, this ancient creature, and going with the whole theme of hybrids, we're like, well, what can we do for a really fun, messed up hybrid monster? And so suddenly it was like, Jonathan and I come up with a lot of ideas for the game on the road to conventions. We drive to a lot of shows, so it's like 8 hours in the car, just him and I looking at each other being insane, like, what if he had a rat and his face opened up into four pieces and he was shooting needles out his throat? And we're like, dude, family, too much. So when it came to, like, the big mega monster, we were like, well, what can we do? And Jonathan was like, make it a hippo. I was like, what? How is it, like, I know hippopotami are going to be doing, like, they're literally one of the most dangerous creatures on the planet to human beings. Like, they will gore you to death in 5 seconds. So, like, I think that's where his mentality was. But I was like, how do I make a hippopotamus, like, monstrous? How do I, like, whip it together? And then I started doing some research and coming up with some ideas, because really, if I don't like something at first, I let it brew around for a while, and then eventually things kind of start mixing together, and I'm like, oh, wait, I can do something with this. So what ended up happening was that two of my favorite ancient creatures on the planet are megalodon sharks and dunkleosteuses. Which, if you don't know what a dunkleosteus is, it is giant. Basically, imagine a giant fish that could fight a megalodon shark that has armor plating. So literally, its entire head looks like this weird beetle carapace with these giant, like, pincher mouth-looking things. It's vicious-looking. So what ended up happening was, like, okay, so what if we took a hippopotami and we took a megalodon shark, and we took this dunkleosteus, we kind of started merging them all together. And as soon as I remember, so Jonathan and Liz were over. We were playing Kingdom Death that night, but then we started talking about Wander and some game ideas. So we were sitting there, and then all of a sudden we started talking about this thing, and the idea started rolling around in my head, and I was like, hold on. I went and grabbed an 11 by 17 sheet of paper and just started, like, rough pencil sketching out a thing, and about 5 or 10 minutes, I came out with a base design for that monster, and it automatically, the three of us were like, that's it. That's the big monster. So then once
he's the, what we call, essentially, the Mega Brute. He shows up in the game for certain scenarios. Certain scenarios has a Megalopotamus already set on the board. And another way he shows up is if a characters ever get to level 5 on their experience track, they automatically summon one. Mm-hmm. The Megalopotamus functions way different than the other enemies, as in he has a hero card, essentially, and his actions each turn, whenever he activates, is determined by a dice roll. If you roll a die and you get an axe, he charges forward to the closest enemy, does 2 damage. If you roll a bow, he does AoE to all enemies in front of him. And if you roll critical, he spawns a little crabling out of his back and starts spawning crab tokens onto the board. And it becomes nasty.
Yeah.
So once you get level 5, you are super powerful, but then you have to deal with the Megalopotamus, who is super scary.
Yeah.
Does that answer the Megalopotamus question?
I think so. I think that's awesome all around. my mic was off for a second. Sorry. So one other question is, Game Ginny saying that she really likes... Game Ginny really likes the... colors, the variety of colors, wants to make sure that we don't end up with lots of kind of brown, boring things. So is there going to be art to support this? Are you going to have alternate art so people can have ideas of different ways to paint the models but are still really bright? What's the plan?
That's a Heath question.
That is a Heath question, isn't it? As far as alternate art, I'm not so sure, just because that would be involved. Most of the heroes and most of the characters have been very kind of carefully crafted. Like, the core 5 heroes I've had those color balances between the five of them. Like, Kira's is mostly blues, a little bit of beige, and some pink. Roland is mostly reds with a little orange. Tank is mostly greens with some beige to them. Like, it's all very carefully crafted in my head. Most of the heroes in the Kickstarter that don't have color yet are going to get color. As far as doing alternate stuff, I'm not so sure, but I don't see why...
We love to see people paint them in their own color palettes. That has been something super exciting. I remember someone did a, Reyna with, like, a Native American tone, and it was super rad. That was super awesome.
Someone painted up Tank to look like a box turtle, or a painted turtle, which have, like, these striations in their actual skin tones. So we love seeing stuff like that.
And also, you know, Heath is a fantastic illustrator. Does great with art. But we also have Elizabeth on the board, who knows what works best for something. Because it's one thing when something's beautiful this big. It's another thing to know what colors work best when it's this big. True. Elizabeth is on board doing that, helping with the art direction on that. When he's like, "Yeah, what do you guys think about doing it this color, or maybe that way?" And Elizabeth's right on top of it. Like, "Oh, this might be better if you push this contrast a bit more here, or maybe a little bit more of a balance in on this character." And so it's been amazing to have her on board of helping with the color choices and art direction, because she knows how it's going to feel when it's this big.
Yeah, her input's been key with a lot of these designs, because I can think of a thousand different ways to illustrate a character, but the funny thing is that working in this industry has taught me very quickly that the miniature painters are true talents. I mean, they are artists of a super high degree. I've learned an ungodly amount from just watching little ways they've handled things, like watching them handle non-metallic metals on a tiny illustration or on a big bust, or watching how they handle textures or lighting or all sorts of stuff. And it's mind-numbing. I don't understand how they do it to a certain degree. And then, honestly, it's in most of my illustration work, is just kind of a pale attempt to try and recapture some of that magic I've seen these mini-painters do with some of these models. So it's been a fantastic thing to watch, and I've learned a ton from it. So I'm hoping in the future, with more work and more stuff, I can really learn to really start digging into textures and more interesting color palettes. Like, the Megalopotamus has got, like, purples and browns and blues and greens and reds and all sorts of stuff inside of there. I did that specifically because I was like, I want to see a painter really try this. I want to see some painters out there and hobbyists really try and tackle this and see what they can do on their own. You know, just because I illustrate it one way doesn't mean a painter has to paint it that way whatsoever. And I know
you
they
always kind of have art in mind. You always have art in mind for most of the concepts of things. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the core of all three of us. You know, my background's video production and animation. Heath's background is all art. Elizabeth's all painting. So we all have art at our heart, right? So that's where all this comes from. All the story and everything like that comes from a creative background and a creative sense of the game.
Cyanide Bear has one last question we'll take. I like models in place of little tokens that represent pets familiar. Are pets and familiars in the work of the future?
Yes, that is something we definitely are planning on doing. Right now, for the moment, there are not pet miniatures, but that is something you should be hopeful for.
Mm-hmm. All right.
It's something we definitely want to do. Just at the moment, for now, there are tokens, but we'll see by the end of this campaign.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that we want to be able to do, but short term, the answer has to be, we'll see. We'll see where the Kickstarter goes. And
we've learned quickly not to overpromise. We're like, we're going to do this, and then we're going to do that, and then this is going to happen. We're like, all right, calm down. Yes, we want to do these things, but the pet question is yes, that's definitely something we want to do.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Is there anything you want to share before we go into our media section and talk about movies this week?
Trying to think if there's any burning desires we got to tell anybody.
Back the Kickstarter.
Yeah, back the game. And if you have, back the game. You are amazing, and we love you very much.
I actually have had some people back it since we've been on. I know that Menoth John has backed it at least, so you may have gotten a few backers from this. Mm-hmm. I'm great, because I love seeing people that are people like me and not industry big corporations get up. It's like a big dream to have this happen. And I like to see when our people that I consider around me have something awesome happen.
Yes, it's been fantastic.
Yeah, we appreciate it. We really do. It's been a dream.
All right. Anything else you want to say about the game before we go to media?
I think we've talked about a lot of it. People have been asking about boss encounters. I will let people know that we'll be recording a new boss fight scenario video this very shortly. We'll get that up as soon as possible.
We've also been asked a lot of questions about rules. We had one guy ask us, like, do you have rules written up for this? Because if you don't, that'd be a travesty. And I was like, that would be a travesty. to put a major game on Kickstarter and make as much money as we have, just be like, I don't know, sorry. We're working
just
on it.
Just trying to make sure
it's well written. Yeah, we have them drafted. We have them written up in a way that we understand and we are happy with. But we want to make sure that I's are dotted, T's are crossed, and that has gone out to a lot of game design friends that we know who can read over it and say, this is gibberish or this makes total sense. So we just really want to make sure that we don't put something out there. Yeah, no premature rules out there, because that could break some things very quickly.
We don't want anything misinterpreted or things get out of hand. We want to make sure it's the purest version of the best way to describe our game. Mm-hmm. And we plan to have that up very soon. Very, very soon. I think that's it.
Let's hit our media section and talk about movies that we saw this week. I will start off. And I actually watched this again because I've done it. I have to do something while I'm painting because my mind has to keep busy, so I paint and watch TV or do some of that. And I watched Hot Fuzz again.
Nice.
While I was painting. And it's still great, no matter how many times I've seen it. I mean, I still laugh at every single time I'm supposed to. It's still, I'm quoting scenes in the movie. Those two guys have the best chemistry in the world.
Oh, yeah. They
play off of each other so well. You can tell that these are two nerds that are like, we are blessed, we're doing shit that we never thought we would, and we're having the best time doing it. I actually stopped painting and was like, yeah, I'm just going to sit here and watch this again because it's such a good movie. I mean, the scenes, the action, everything about it was just right. And you look at it and you're like, this movie shouldn't have been good. I mean, it really shouldn't have been good because it's, you know, low budget, small production, you know, not this huge thing, but it's because of those two guys. They have such great chemistry that I don't think they could put out anything, and I think it will be great. Because they did where they tried to recreate Star Wars, and they were doing one with C-3PO and R2-D2, and that came out. I don't know if it came out recently, but I saw it recently, and that was still funny. I think I watched it three times back to back because it was stupid funny because they just have great chemistry with each other. So, on a scale of a bottle of Kraken to shots, I would say if it's not your thing, you might want to have one shot of Kraken because that, it might not be your thing, but overall, that movie was fun as hell. And let's go, Jonathan, what'd you watch this week?
All right, just the other day, actually, got out of the house because Elizabeth was like, you need to get out of the house. You're going crazy staring at this Kickstarter. And being the awesome wife that she is, we went and saw the new movie, It. That movie, as a kid, terrified me. I got to see that movie when I was way too young, the first movie, It, with Tim Curry as Pennywise the Clown. I saw that when I was probably about 5 years old because my older brother is a jerk. And had me watch it with him. And I wasn't really scared of the clown as much as I was of like the terrifying stuff happening with the plumbing and all the other things, and then no one else being able to see it but the kids. So after I watched that movie, I like wouldn't go to the bathroom with the door closed. Like, was just terrified of everything. I wasn't scared of clowns. And then so I saw they're making a remake of it, and I was skeptical because there's so many reboots that kind of butcher the original stuff. But man, it was great. It was so great, which is great to see because I've always been a diehard you know, 80s horror movie fan, 90s horror movie fan, and they really did it justice. It actually broke a ton of records, box office records. I think it's the second highest rated R movie of all time, right underneath Deadpool, and the highest grossing horror movie on the opening weekend, which was super awesome. The kids in that show were so real, because the dialogue between the boys is so true to how we all talk to each other as boys as 12-year-olds, with just foul-mouthed awfulness, like talking about each other's moms and sisters and just grotesque stuff that they would say to each other, constantly bashing each other. And the dynamic of the acting was just was very, very, very good. The clown was terrifying. It is very hard to top Tim Curry as Pennywise the Clown, so I'm very happy they did him very differently. They didn't just try to recreate the same thing Tim Curry did. They gave him his own unique spin. He acted very differently. His lines delivered differently. And there was a lot more to the movie as well. A lot of people don't realize the first movie was actually a straight-to-TV movie. Mm-hmm. It was like a TV miniseries. So now in the modern day, there's a lot more they could do with it. The characters had a lot more meat to them. And it was a little bit more true to the books. I'm actually listening... I read half the book a long time ago in high school, and now I'm listening to an audiobook, and it's fantastic. If you're a horror movie fan, I wouldn't say it's overly terrifying, but then again, I'm a fan of horror movies, so I'm a hard judge on that. But it's a good scare. There are some scenes in that really got me, and I found like a little snippet of one of them online to show Heath, because Heath's a chump and won't go see the horror movies.
I got an active enough imagination.
An excuse. I'm too creative to see scary things. I get it.
No, I already do, man. That's the problem.
But the movie was great. I highly recommend it. I think he's got like an 80 something on Rotten Tomatoes now, which is actually extremely high for scary movies. I enjoyed every bit of it. One thing I thought that was neat was so the original movie was based, like, the kids were based in 1950s, and then their adult lives were in the 1980s, which made sense for them, because the movie came out in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And in this version, the past of the kids is based in the 80s, and then when they come out with the second part next year, the adults will be, I'm assuming, modern day, which is exciting to see.
So if you're going to give it a scale of, I have to drink a whole bottle of Kraken to watch it, to a shot, to no shots, what would you give it?
So it was a lot of shots bad?
A lot of shots bad because you have to get drunk enough to sit through it.
Oh, well, I don't drink anymore, so I could just not... I enjoy all of it.
But for the layman and the people out there...
Yeah, I would say no shots. You can just go see it. If you are... Well, it depends. If you're not... If you don't like scary movies, don't go see it. If you're interested in scary movies, go see it.
Seth, you got anything for us this week?
So I didn't watch a movie this week, but I did get to watch the pilot for Orville, the new Seth MacFarlane show. And it is a tremendous love letter to Star Trek and a comedy. And if only those two things worked together at the same time, it might have been a good show. I think it's got some real possibilities. The cast they have is actually really good. The writers they have is pretty good, but you just, as you were watching it, you're never quite sure where this was supposed to really be coming down. There are two characters that, if you do watch this, it's free on Hulu right now. You could do worse. The helmsman and the navigator are sort of the Chekhov and Sulu characters. They're hysterical. That when they're on the screen, very funny things are about to happen. As Maximum DT is pointing out, it's basically Galaxy Quest, the TV show, except they're trying to still be too serious. Even in Galaxy Quest, the movie, which was an amazing movie, the action is ridiculous. The everything that they're doing is sort of over the top, and they, in the Orville show, dial it back a little too much and try to make it a little too real. I would give this, keeping in mind that it's a 45-minute show, 2 shots of Kraken. Yeah. I'm hoping it gets better and that this is just a rough pilot as they find their feet. But right now it's pretty pretty bad.
Oh, see, I got to disagree with you on that one.
Okay, go for it.
I watched it, and I took it as like the Galaxy Quest TV show, mm-hmm. and laughed all the way through it. It had some really great lines. Of course, it was a start of a series, so it's a pilot, yeah. so it can change. But I thought it was done really well. It spoofed off of everything. It made fun of everything that was Star Trek, made fun of everything that was going on. What I thought was really interesting, though, it was actually a decent science fiction show, though. And that kind of scared me. I was like, it's not a bad science fiction show. Of course, it's Star Trek, you know, spoofing, but I was like, that's not a bad sci-fi show. Because, I mean, the graphics were still good. It was still decent sets. It still looked nice. So, I don't know. I hope it does get better, because it was actually pretty good, in my opinion.
Yeah, and this is one of the things, is that's actually exactly my point of, it could have been a really good sci-fi show, and they've just gone for it. Maxim DT's pointed out that probably part of the problem is that a lot of the jokes were spoiled, so you're kind of waiting for something else after it. So I'm definitely going to still watch another episode or two before I make final adjustment on the show, but right now I'm definitely staying wary.
Hey. Mm-hmm. Did you do anything this week, movie-wise, TV?
I did, and it's going to make all of your skin crawl because of how 90s-tastic it is. I watched Spawn.
Oh, man!
I needed a solid nostalgia boost shot into my arm, and I remember being a kid and being like, yeah, Spawn, this movie's going to be awesome. And I remember thinking that when I was an ignorant child. So I like to put on movies and stuff when I am working on grad, something that I know I can just phase out and start working on it. Spawn was so ridiculously over the top that I had to disengage and actually watch it again. And I will remind you that, oh my God, it is horrendously good and bad at the same time. I don't know how they do it. Like, ultimately, way more bad. But I remember at the time, like, there were some graphics where all of a sudden his cape turns into a motorcycle and he's riding around taking, like, rocket shots from John Leguizamo, who's playing a fat demonic clown. Just remember thinking, that's so cool, I want that motorcycle. Or he flies off and his cape is, like, fluttering around. And when I was a kid, I was like, that's awesome. It does not age well.
No, it does not.
Like, all the scenes where Spawn goes to hell... It deals with, like, forgive me, I do not know the name. It may be Satan. It's probably not. It's probably some mega demon. I don't know the name of. There you go. So he was there, and, like, everything else in the movie, most other things, like, this is the early days of CGI, and, like, they did a lot of, like, actual good prosthetic work. Like, Spawn mm-hmm. and his suit looked pretty cool. I remember that specifically. Then they showed him... in hell, and it's clearly like they just took a dude in a Spawn suit and then like kind of got him like gyrating and like doing these weird like hootenannies and like hoedowns, and then they put that on a green screen and then they layered that behind it 30 times and then we're like shifting it around. They didn't even scale them right. There was like mm-hmm. big ones and small ones, but they're like doing a hoedown. I remember laughing so hysterically, and then
who's there a hoedown in Spawn?
Dude, I swear if you watch those background Spawns, you'll see one guy like doing a jig. It's ridiculous.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember seeing like the demon overlord pop up, and he does the classic demon voice, but the CG is so bad. It's like he's like it's a model that's got like hair on it. Like a high schooler could make this now. But the hair was all transparent, and then there was like fake fire that they just slapped on top of it, and it was like, I saw what they were trying to do, but they failed so utterly and miserably. Oh. All I know is they're doing a remake of it, and it mm-hmm. kind of makes me sad, because the first one was so gloriously bad that, I don't know. We'll see. They may actually make something pretty spectacular from it, but who knows. As far as how many shots you need from one shot to a bottle... I think you're going to need the whole liquor store on hand just to get through 80% of it. I just remember the two villains early in the movie, right when they killed the main character and he turned into Spawn, where they were in a brewery vat and they were wearing silver skin jumpsuits and they had all these straps and stuff. It was the most Rob Liefeld thing I've ever seen, just straps and pockets and guns, and it is so ridiculously bad. So yeah, that's what I watched this week. Not It or The Orville, something actually probably decent and fun to watch. No, I watched Spawn.
I heard that with the remake, rather than following the story of Spawn himself, it's going to be the two detectives from the comics, because the writers read the comics and were like, Spawn is the least compelling character we've seen in a long time.
Yes. He's kind of like Ghost Rider. I always everyone always loves Ghost Rider as a comic book hero. But if you read Ghost Rider, he is not that interesting at all.
No.
He's just a cool-looking guy on a motorcycle with a burning skull. But he's probably the most uninteresting Marvel character there is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's when HBO did the cartoon. Did you all watch that?
Yeah.
The detectives in that were great. I was seeing them on there, and then they were very well worth watching for those two guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, I'd be down for that. Just as long as they bring back John Leguizamo. I think he was probably the only part of that movie that I was all right, I'm in. Fat demon clown, let's do it.
I heard an interview with him, and they were asking him, what role was he most proud of? And he said that was actually the role he was most proud of, because he had no script. But the entire thing, just whatever would come out of his mouth, and they were kind of stuck with it.
I'd like to think, so there's a scene where Spawn's visiting his, daughter in a school, and they're in the gymnasium, and then all of a sudden John Leguizamo's character shows up with a fat clown in, a cheerleader costume. I'd like to think they made that up on the spot, and they just looked at the costume department, and they're just like, sew a cheerleader thing to this fat suit, and let's see what happens.
I can see that. We actually had a last-minute question that I wanted to ask, and it's actually really important, and it's actually something good, and it's about your game.
Okay, cool.
Are y'all planning on doing a Watch It Played?
I love Rodney. We'll have to talk to him once we actually have copies to be able to send out to our viewers.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something we definitely will want to do. Rodney does a fantastic work. Lance Hinkle from Learn to Play actually got his hands on an early prototype version and has been doing kind of small tutorials of the basics right now. Once we get a full version, Lance, I'm sure, will be doing another full version of the game, and we definitely would love Rodney to do some stuff and get it to out as many channels as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I actually think that's a brilliant idea, because there's many games, board games I'll go and look at, and I'll say, who's doing a Watch It Play It or a Learn to Play It, and it'll decide whether I buy it or not after it's been on the market.
And also, as a video production guy, I plan to also do what I've been doing for a lot of companies recently. What I'm actually doing for USAOPLAY today is a digital how to play. So it will be animated version of the components moving around and stuff like that, explaining the basics of the rules, so it gives you enough to understand the opening concepts of the game so you can jump right in.
All right. Well, that is our podcast, guys. Thank you for joining us. This is a new high score for us. We've never had two big guests on. I'm really proud of what you've done. I'm really excited to play the game. Other than that, I'm Gonzo.
I'm Seth.
I'm Jonathan.
And we're going to play our outro music. Thank you for going.
Thank you, guys.
Are we still recording? I have a horrible feeling that Gonzo's going to bring his microphone into the bathroom. It's
fun.
While recording.
Oh, we're still recording.